I'm Laura.
And I'm Georgiana.
And this is De Canterbury Tales. All right. Welcome to De Canterbury Tales, a beverage book club podcast. This is Laura, and today I will be your host. This is a BBC episode, which stands for a beverage book club. And today, y'all, is a very special Pub Day episode, our very first ever Pub Day episode. Congratulations to Andy Bartz, author of The Spare Room, which hit shelves today, June 20th. Congratulations, Andy. We had the pleasure of having her on the show, and if you love this episode, be sure to scroll back in the archives of the show and listen to her episode from last year about her book, We Were Never Here. There is a spoiler alert in the episode prior to when we start spoiling it, so you, dear listener, can hit pause when you need to. I'm not going to do all the witty banter. Georgiana was not able to make the recording today, so just to let y'all know, there will not be any witty banter. I'm sure you guys would love to hear me wax on and on about myself, but I will spare you the trouble. But I do have a pairing for you. I will share some stuff from the publisher on the plot. Because it just came out today, there aren't a lot of reviews for us to choose from. So we're just going to take what the publisher gave us, give you a little bit of background about Andy, and then you get to listen to our interview with Andy Bartz. So my 0% ABV pairing. So again, my section will for always be a zero proof option. So I'm giving you, while Georgiana will give you the wine pairing, don't worry, we're still to Canterbury Tales. I will give you, if you are choosing not to drink for whatever reason, you also can get a fun non-alcoholic beverage to sip while you read. So the 0% ABV pairing is from Curious Elixirs. And I grabbed all this information from their website, CuriousElixirs.com. So Curious Elixirs are booze-free craft cocktails infused with adaptogens. Yeah, y'all. Adaptogens to help you unwind. Our beverages are handmade with the best ingredients and no refined sugars. We created Curious Elixirs because we believe non-alcoholic drinks should be unusually delicious, well-crafted, and good for bodies and souls. So we began a mission to serve up the world's best booze-free craft cocktail. And it seems we struck a chord. People from all walks of life joined our community. Some of us are sober. Some of us just drink less alcohol in our quest to live our best lives. This is all to say that whoever you are and however you found us, Curious Elixirs was made with you in mind, which I think is kind of sweet. Our flavors are bold and crafted for the adventurous. Each flavor is a collaboration between our team of world-class bartenders, herbalists, and food scientists, and we proudly use only organic juices, herbs, spices, roots, barks, and botanicals to make your mouth dance. Each Curious Elixir also bolsters the body, using the mysterious properties of plants, from an ancient botanical that increases serotonin and dopamine precursors, to another that increases circulation and was used in Mayan culture as an aphrodisiac. So, overall, I will say shout out to Curious Elixir. They sent me a pack of Curious number 4, and I was very excited about that because that was what I wanted to pair with this book, and I will tell you why in just a minute. So Curious Elixir sent me a pack of Curious number 4, and it is exactly what I wanted to pair. Their product is very good. I tried a lot of non-alcoholic cocktails, and these pay an homage to cocktails, but they are uniquely their own drink. And if you are not someone who likes overly sweet beverages, that's why you kind of liked the cocktail world, because you're getting a beverage that's flavorful and tasty. This is basically all the joy of that, but without the alcohol. So my pairing is Curious number 4. And according to the website, it is for when you have a busy mind, which leads me into Kelly from the book. Her mind is absolutely busy. Curious number 4 is best described as a Sicilian blood orange green mandarin spritz, invoking both the ever-popular Aperol spritz with the delicate effervescence of Prosecco. Enjoy the de-inflammatory properties of ginseng and turmeric, as well as holy basil to reduce stress. Serve in a wine glass, on the rocks, or neat, garnished with an orange slice. The price point is you get 8 cocktails in 4 bottles, so it's 2 cocktails per bottle, for $40. And this one has a little bit of bitterness with the green mandarin. It has light effervescence and heavy on the orange flavor, but it's not like orange soda sweet. It has like almost no sweetness, and the holy basil gives it a really rounded flavor, really herbaceous. It's delicious. So I highly recommend run over to Curious Elixirs and order some Curious Number 4, or check out, they have a flavor quiz. So you can take the little flavor quiz on their website and it'll pair you with your perfect bev. So shout out to Curious Elixirs, give them a try. And on to About the Spare Room. This is from the publisher, and it does not, this section does not have spoilers. It is directly from the publisher to get people to buy the book. So no spoilers yet, I promise. About the Spare Room. Staying with a friend and her husband is sexier and deadlier than anyone could have imagined in this delightfully salacious domestic suspense novel from the New York Times bestselling author of the Reese's Book Club pick, We Were Never Here, which DeCanterbury Tales covered last year, and that is where we interviewed Andy for the first time. So if you loved We Were Never Here, scroll back to, I believe, June of last year, and that is our first time talking to Andy. A fresh and sexy ride, perfect for reading poolside. That is from People, who gave it Best New Book. Sexy, atmospheric, deliciously creepy, and ingeniously plotted. The best kind of up all night page turner. And that was from Lucy Foley, number one New York Times bestselling author of The Paris Apartment and The Guest List. And on to our plot. Synopsis / teaser. Kelly's new life in Philadelphia has turned into a nightmare. She's friendless and jobless, and the lockdown has her trapped in a tiny apartment with the man she gave up everything for, who's just called off their wedding. The only bright spot in her newly rekindled friendship with her childhood friend Sabrina, now a glamorous best-selling author with a handsome, high-powered husband. When Sabrina and Nathan offer Kelly an escape hatch, volunteering their spare room of their remote Virginia mansion, she jumps at the chance to run away from her old life. There, Kelly secretly finds herself falling for both her enchanting hosts, until one night, a wild and an unexpected threesome leads the couple to open their marriage for her. At first, Kelly loves being part of this risque new world, but when she discovers that the last woman they invited into their marriage is missing, she starts to wonder if they could be dangerous and if she might be next. Packed with Andrea Bartz's signature tension, twist, and toxic relationships, The Spare Room marks an edgy, boundary-pushing new direction from the master of the feminist thriller. And I have two more quotes for you. This one is from Elle magazine. Andrea Bartz has returned to deliver. The suspense story set in a Virginia mansion features some eyebrow-raising twists, especially when protagonist Kelly finds herself charmed by her host and welcomed into their bed. This one is from Nita Prose, number one New York Times bestselling author of The Maid, an enticing, twisty, and seductive thriller about obsession, desire, and revenge. And I definitely agree with all of that. This book is a little spicy, and, you know, it's just, I loved the book, so I hope you guys do too. And a little bit about Andrea Bartz. She is a Brooklyn-based journalist and New York Times bestselling author of We Were Never Here, The Lost Night, and The Herd. Her work has appeared in The Wall Street Journal, Marie Claire, Vogue, Cosmopolitan, Women's Health, Martha Stewart Living, Red Book, Elle, and many other outlets. And she's held editorial positions at Glamour, Psychology Today, and Self, among other publications. So y'all, from here on out, we warn you that our interview contains spoilers for the plot. If you have not read the book and do not want to have anything spoiled for you, go ahead and hit pause now, go to your local bookseller and get The Spare Room, read it, and then come back and hit play. This is your last chance to hit pause in 3, 2, 1. Okay, we warned you. For everyone still listening, we hope you enjoy our interview with Andrea Bartz, the author of The Spare Room.
Woo!
Welcome right back to DeCanterbury Tales.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
We are so happy to have you, Andrea Bartz, to talk about The Spare Room, Woo. Your fourth novel.
I did not come prepared. Everybody else has theirs like next. I was like, I didn't come prepared.
Hey, I got it for us. So it's been about a year since we last spoke. And so time for a life update. How are you? How are your fur babies? And did you add any new robes to the collection?
We're both wearing robes.
Why am I not wearing a robe right now? I'm mad.
We can pause if you want to go get one.
You can pause if you need one.
It is tempting, but it's actually really hot in this room. So I feel like adding a layer is like not my best move at the moment. This is also reminding me I was going to shut this door. Although as soon as I do, oh yeah, already the cat's like a closed door. I need to start meowing about that. Like you didn't care about the door a second ago. Fur babies are great. I don't know. Did I have a dog last time we spoke?
Yes, I think the dog was new. The dog was new.
But we were discussing the couch dynamic.
Yes. So they still are getting along great. They're, you know, they have like a sleeping schedule where they're like both on the bed and then they're both on the sofa and it's really cute. Often they're both here in the office. Right now I just have the cat with me. But yeah, animals are great and life updates otherwise are really good and probably kind of the same. But yeah, just getting a book out into the world, which is terrifying and exciting. How are you guys?
We're great.
Yeah.
We're great to have you here. We have gotten to re-interview some of our authors. And so it's so nice to just kind of see the evolution. And that's kind of something we're going to ask you about is just the process of new books. Mm-hmm. So Laura, take it away.
I was like, are you going to steal my question?
No.
This is your fourth novel.
Yes.
How did you prepare for writing this book? Was there anything different that you did? Or do you have a go-to method when you write?
Yeah, I still four books in. I'm writing my fifth now, and I still feel like I have no idea how to write a book. I keep swearing that like the next one is going to be, I probably said this last time. I keep swearing the next one is going to be the one that I like outline and like figure everything out beforehand and like know what I'm doing. And then like that completely falls apart as soon as I attempt to write an outline or write down something, but then attempt to start writing the book. And it's just the characters like totally want to do their own thing. And like everything surprises me. So in that sense, my process has stayed the same. And in that sense, it's like chaotic neutral and just like trying things out and like throwing words on a page. And like, I have no idea where this like speeding bus is going, to mix all my metaphors. But this one was quite different because it's my most personal book yet. You know, I put a lot of myself into all of my narrators, all of my protagonists. But in this case, you know, it's about a character who, during, you know, the lockdown, early days of the pandemic, like discovers her bisexuality and starts dating a woman and really rethinks everything that she thought she wanted out of life. She just identified as straight and thought she wanted to be a mother and thought she wanted 2.5 kids and a minivan and all those things, and goes through sort of this transformative experience in the lockdown that makes her sort of recognize like, wait, I don't have to go after those things just because I thought I did. Like, did they actually come from me or did those come from society? And now that life like that was barreling along at a million miles an hour hit this wall and we all sort of like woke up from the trance of like staying so busy, things are different and she's looking at things in a different light. And that was all very true of me. I mean, my experience did not include the, you know, the throuple or the missing people or dead bodies or anything else that makes my books, you know, suspense. But I was putting a lot of myself into this, sort of this character arc and this character journey. And that was really scary and really vulnerable. And I think I'm feeling kind of more freaked out going into the lead up to this book coming out. We're recording right before the book comes out. And I'm feeling, I think more, sort of jumpy and, you know, nervous and also brave and excited than any of my other ones before. So I'm proud of the book and I hope other people like it too.
It was great. And I honestly, you said every single adjective that I was thinking as you were talking. So vulnerable. This is so scary. But the fact that you just say, this is my truth. This is who I am. Let's put it in a book. Let's add a wife and a husband and make it a throuple. Why not? Like, let's go. But that's got to be kind of terrifying just to put yourself on a page.
Yeah. And I felt like, go ahead.
Oh, and we are releasing this on your book release day. So happy release day in advance.
Thank you so much. I am taking that in. The future part of me is feeling that. What was I just going to say? Yeah, while I was actually writing it, it still was the pandemic. I started working on it in 2020. So it still felt like a million miles away from my upbringing and, you know, my conservative family and the Christian upbringing and even the good friends in New York City who are really, you know, open-minded and love me no matter what, but knew me in a certain light. Like when I started working on this, I didn't even really have to like soft launch or talk about this new identity and the new ways that I was seeing myself. So it didn't feel that scary when I started writing. And it was only like in the years since then, as we got closer for it to come out, that I was like, oh, people are gonna read this, huh? Interesting.
Out of the pandemic bubble we go.
Yeah, exactly. Like back into the very real world.
Yeah. And so this is actually the first book that we've covered that takes place in COVID. And while we suspect this setting, you know, may be more common in the future, this is a first for us. And so what played into your decision to set the novel during COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually pitched the idea to my editor without the pandemic element. You know, I pitched the bones were the same. There's this woman who's just, you know, quit her job and moved across the country for her partner. And then her fiance, he calls off the wedding and, you know, in her sort of misery, she strikes up restarts a friendship with someone from high school, and that person invites her down and she moves in with them. I had all of the same elements in the setup, but I didn't want to put it in the pandemic because, and you'll remember this, back in sort of late 2020, we all were saying, oh my God, I never want to read a single freaking thing about the pandemic. We were like, no way, no how. I see why there's no book set in the 1918 Spanish flu. Like, I don't want to read about it or think about it. I just want it to be over.
Yeah.
So I was in that mindset too, where I was like, that would be such a handicap. Why would I add that element? And it was, and at this point I'd only written, I don't know, maybe 10 or 20,000 words. The book was not complete. I was just pitching an idea. And she very wisely was like, I think we want it to be the pandemic because it was the first time that so many people shook up their living situations and were living with other people and forming these like pods, these really intimate living situations and sort of their chosen families without power differentials. Like I knew so many single adults like myself who were just living with couples or living with other families. And like we all, you know, there are people who were like, on what was supposed to be a 5-day vacation when lockdown struck and they were just there for months. Like we all had these weird living situations that she thought it would make it more believable. And she also made the great point that like the pandemic set up this natural setting for a locked room feeling where, I don't know, if somebody went missing during the pandemic or somebody killed somebody during the pandemic or you heard screams from next door during the pandemic, nobody would do anything about it. Like nobody was interacting with other people. It wouldn't be weird if you just stopped showing up because nobody was showing up anywhere. Right. You could keep your secrets locked inside. And there was really this eerie feeling of like, who even knows what's going on behind locked doors, right? So she kind of convinced me with those things. And in fact, she was like, let's just try it. Just try it, see how it feels, see if it works. And I was like, okay, I mean, I'm not going to write a book about the pandemic. It's not in any way about the pandemic, but I'll try it as sort of a backdrop. And upon actually writing it, I recognized some of that stuff that I said earlier about how the pandemic forced a lot of people to suddenly, you know, take a good, hard look at their lives and like confront, make these major changes that they suddenly realize, like, my life doesn't need to be what I thought it was. And I think we all know people who went through divorces or who got back together with exes or who moved out of cities to, you know, moved all over the place. All of these life changes were sort of born out of it. And I realized that like a really key part of the authenticity and the relatability, the sort of universal, you know, universality of this story is that so many of us went through that period of suddenly like, oh my gosh, like what even is my life? Mm-hmm. And that was really born out of the pandemic and felt, I felt a lot more relatable with that as a setting. And then there's also just practically like thriller writers often need to work pretty hard to explain why their main character doesn't just get out of Dodge, right? Like that's always something that reviewers say, like, why doesn't she just leave? Why didn't she just, I would have left the first day, da da da. And the pandemic did a lot of that work for me because literally you couldn't go anywhere. Where's she gonna go? She doesn't have a car. We weren't taking flights. Like she doesn't have anywhere else to be or go. So because of all of those things, I think my editor was ultimately right that making it not a pandemic book, but a book set within that certain time period sort of worked on a number of levels.
Yeah, it laid the groundwork for it because when I realized it was pandemic, I was like, okay, where are we going? What are we doing? And then, but it all played into each other so well. The fact that, you know, Nathan and Sabrina want to keep it a secret. Okay. Secret. Fine. Easy. She can't go anywhere. She's stuck. Nobody, to your point, is going to come check the door. And for all the world knows, she was making banana bread. Mm-hmm. And she put it on social media like the rest of us.
Yep. Just making that sourdough, just getting through 2020 like so many people did.
Or her little moss garden, whatever one she wanted.
Whatever. Yeah. Take your pick. What did you get into? I didn't have her get into needlepoint like me, but I did that in crocheting. That was my
adult coloring books. That's what happened for me.
Yeah. Yeah. We all took on some weird hobbies.
I got really into cottagecore.
Cottagecore.
Really into cottagecore.
It was, well, what's funny too, is that so, I think now I'm seeing more and more thrillers that are coming out around this time that are sort of billing themselves as like gothic. And that very much was what I was going for with this entire story that takes place in this mansion, right? And it's remote and there's sort of sexual tension and what's going on and everything's sort of heightened and a little bit slow burn. So to me, it was very much like this, throwback to like the gothic novels that we all love. And I thought I was kind of the only one. And now there's so many thrillers coming out now that have that gothic feel or like kind of are built that way. And I think it's just that so many of us writers, we're trapped staring at our own four walls and we're like, what if there were a murder here? Like just couldn't help but set our dark imaginations were going wild. So while you were doing like lovely, adorable, darling cottagecore, we were imagining the darkest things about our pandemic settings.
Oh man. So social media played a major role in connection and also trauma blocking during the pandemic. Kelly obsesses and virtually stalks Sabrina, fantasizes about her life. She even daydreams about what kind of sex Sabrina and Nathan are having. And the social media fixation has caused severe mental health issues across the country and around the world. And with Kelly, it doesn't seem like she realizes how unhealthy that fixation actually is. So what were you trying to convey to the reader about kind of social media use and abuse through that dynamic?
Yeah, that's a great question. So early on in the pandemic, again, I was alone in a studio apartment, but for my cat, I was trapped within 380 square feet every single day, day in and day out. I didn't have any good friends in walking distance. And so for me, social media was taking up a huge amount of my day. And it felt like it was filling the hole in a certain way. I was, you know, talking to friends, but also yeah, the algorithm starts noticing that you're like weirdly clicking a lot on this person. You don't even, you know that thing where you're like, who is this person? And so you tap on them and then the algorithm's like, oh, you must be obsessed. And then keeps showing you stuff. And then suddenly you feel like you know their life and you're like, oh my gosh, their three-year-old has a cold. Like, I hope it's nothing. And it's like, I don't even know this person anymore. I like went to camp with them in third grade or whatever. So I felt like I was living my whole social life on social media. And I remember I started seeing my therapist over Zoom, which felt very novel at the time. And she asked me one week, because she knew that I was sort of making an effort to like bike and see people. We could do the 6 foot, you know, distanced social hangouts. And she was like, okay, so did you see anyone face to face in the past week? And I was like, no, but like, I think it's fine. I like, you know, had some, you know, was talking to people on Instagram. I talked to someone on the phone, like, it's fine. And she's like, so you didn't see anyone, you didn't have any face-to-face interactions this week? And I was like, well, no, but, and it was right at that period where we're all kind of getting used to it. And she was right. It was starting to feel normal. And she was like, so here's the thing about the human brain. The human brain is really good at making whatever the status quo is feel normal and fine. So your brain can even convince you that like, you don't really need in-person social interaction, but like you do, humans do. So I think it would be good for you to like call up your sister and find a way that you can both bike somewhere in the middle and see her. And I was so fascinated by that because I really felt fine. And I like to think that as, you know, a psychological fiction writer, I'm like pretty aware of what's going on in my own head and with everyone else. And that was around when I decided, like, I think I need to find a way to get out of this living situation, which led to me moving in with a friend and her husband and their 2-year-old, which again was not sexy or anything or suspicious or any of those things, but it did inspire the book. And I felt like we had this experiment. So let me start that again. I feel like there's been this discussion of like, is social media good or bad for, let's say, teenagers? Because like, yeah, they're spending a lot of time and it's hijacking their minds on it, but they are like finding their people and they can interact in ways that we couldn't. And like, maybe it's actually really good. And so we all had this perfect experiment where like, we couldn't do one side of it, this either or of like in person versus on your phone. We couldn't do the in-person thing. And like, the answer for me was like, oh, it's not good. It was not good for my mental health to only have that element. So in the book, I was playing with how perfect Sabrina and Nathan seem. And that starts with social media, which all of us are projecting as close to perfection as we can on our social media, right? Even if your brand is to be like quirky and like, oh, I'm a mess, it's still curated. So she sort of begins to fall for these masks that they're presenting to the world. And then she gets to their home and their home is even more beautiful than she could have imagined. And she's like, I can't believe I get to be here. But so much of it is still, you know, not looking beyond the surface and not looking at all of the darkness that's sort of lurking just below the surface of these beautiful people, this beautiful home, this beautiful setting. And she is sort of, you know, making the same mistake because she is updating her social media while she's there. Kelly, our narrator, is updating to sort of brag about like, look, I'm sitting next to a pool now. Like, look, I'm winning at lockdown. I'm kind of having a great pandemic. And so I don't know, I wanted to play with that huge gap that we often have between what we're presenting on social media and how we're actually feeling. And I mean, even talking to you guys, like my social media is nothing but how excited I am about the book. And then as soon as I'm talking to you, real people, even though it is with a screen in between us, it's like, oh yeah, I'm terrified. I'm also excited, but like, let's be very clear. So I think when we were sort of robbed of the opportunity to be real with people in person, it became way too easy to become fixated on the digital versions that we saw of everyone else and the digital version that we were curating of ourselves. And that was something, and that was a theme I wanted to explore throughout the book.
Yeah, you're really calling me out because I'm thinking back to my social media during the pandemic. And the one picture I posted is me at the beach holding a baby. And
hashtag
like,
winning.
Everything's fine. Everything's fine. Everything's great. And I'm like, oh no, that was a traumatizing period of my life. Nothing was fine.
Yeah.
But me and the baby, doing great.
Doing great. Look, having, yeah, making people jealous.
Yep, exactly.
Look at my plants.
The plants are thriving. So am I.
Oh, man. So switching gears just a little bit, but so Kelly hears the word cop and physical abuse and assumes that Elizabeth's ex is male. And she immediately admonishes herself when she realizes Elizabeth's ex was female. And admittedly, I assumed male as well. And it seemed like the way you wrote this development to lead to this kind of moment. And so why do you think we stereotype this occupation and characteristic to the male sex?
Yeah, I'm going to ask that if we include this, that it's behind a spoiler alert, because it is kind of a, you know, surprise and twist that hopefully plays with readers' own expectations when they discover that, and it comes fairly deep into the novel. That said, I didn't want to go super deep into, you know, police stuff in this book. I felt like that was not what this book was about, even though it's, you know, taking place in 2020 when we were having a lot of those discussions. But it was more about me exploring my own, you know, even when I was dating a woman, I still found myself jumping to conclusions about other people's partners, or people jumping to conclusions about me when I said that I was dating somebody new. And they would want to know, you know, like, oh, what's his name? And of course, none of it was badly intentioned. And of course, I almost exclusively dated men before. So of course they assumed that, but, you know, I wrote an own voices book, and I want to continue doing that where it, in future books, like, I don't even want necessarily the queerness to be the focus. I think we should just have characters who are straight and who are queer and who are neurodiverse and who are, you know, disabled in different ways and racially diverse. Like, I think we should have people represented of all backgrounds and kinds. And it shouldn't be, what we need to sort of work through is our just knee-jerk assumptions that we always go to when we hear about, oh, she's dating someone, you picture a man. We always jump to sort of the dominant narrative, right? You know, as white people, if I say picture a woman, you probably picture a white woman. And then if I say picture a Black woman, then you realize that you've been picturing a white woman. So I was sort of just playing with this idea that I was working through myself of, like, how can we begin to break those knee-jerk assumptions that when you meet someone and they mention their partner, you make an assumption, when, you know, whether it's about their partner or their pronouns, that's a new one that I'm trying to get into the habit of asking about instead of just assuming. And so, yeah, my sort of cheeky way of playing with it in this book was by kind of tricking the reader and having them go through the same little journey and moment of self-revelation that the narrator does. Of, oh, wait, why, you know, I think of myself as progressive and open-minded. So why did I jump to that kind of conclusion?
And I totally admonished myself too, when I saw it, because I literally am redoing, I work for a university and I'm redoing applications and handbooks and removing her, his, mm-hmm. and mother, father, parent. And so I live this day in and day out trying to be inclusive and respectful of all people. And I'm like, she got me. She got me, because I literally was like, yep, me too, girl. Me too.
Did it. Yeah. I mean, I'm right there with, to be clear, I'm right there with the reader and I'm right there with Kelly. So I don't pretend to be better than anyone else, but you know, sometimes you need those little wake up moments to be like, oh my gosh, like just recently I kept calling my neighbor, Nick, referring to them as he, him. And then finally they mentioned being non-binary. And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry I didn't ask. Like, what are your pronouns? Like, why didn't I think to ask that earlier? That was so, I just had it wrong for a while. So just those little things where you know, it's a tiny bit of labor and it's like the least that we all can do to be respectful to others. And so, you know, if I can put a little bit of gentle messaging that none of us are, you know, assuming the best, assuming we're all doing our best, like just a gentle reminder to not jump to conclusions for myself as well.
Yeah. I was at Sephora yesterday and on the name tags, they have pronouns on the name tags.
Which I love was that. Cool.
I was like, oh, that's so helpful.
Yes.
Yeah. So again, spoiler alerts, everyone that listens to the show knows that once we have an author on, like, spoilers are going to happen. We
All right. All bets are off.
So all bets are off, everybody. You got us again with the twist. We did not expect Mike to be the culprit. Did you always know that he was going to be the killer, or was this something where Mike chose it for himself?
Mike definitely chose it for himself. I was having the hardest time figuring out what happened in the second half of this book. I did know, and here's the other huge spoiler, but if anyone's gotten this far, it's their own fault. The other big spoiler about Elizabeth being alive and well, that was also a surprise to me. I, like the reader, I think, kind of assumed that, like, that Sabrina and Nathan had done something terrible to her, or maybe her ex had, but, like, I did not think that she was still on the planet, let alone like lurking around the area. So as soon as she showed up, I was sort of like, oh, all the notions I had about where this book is going next are just, like, completely out the window. I have no idea what's happening now. And several people who've read it have remarked that the last third, maybe 40%, is just, like, increasingly bananas and just, like, you know, twists coming out of left field and reveals. And, you know, hopefully they're coming out of left field, but in a way that feels earned. And no, I was just sort of following the characters where they wanted to go. And I desperately was trying to figure out, oh, we have a fur baby on the screen.
This is Chicken Nugget. He manages to make it onto every episode since I found him last year.
Hi, Chicken Nugget. What a great name, too. Oh, so pretty.
He hitched a ride in a McDonald's parking lot.
Oh, big fan. Me too, bud. Me too.
Anyway.
Anyway, what was I saying before a beautiful cat showed up on the screen? Oh yeah, I was just desperately trying to figure out, you know, who was the killer here and why. And I sort of settled on, okay, I guess it was Nathan based on all these other pieces. And I still had, like, a little bug in my ear of, like, but was it actually Sabrina? Was there something that still hasn't been explained? And I was just sort of following as, like, the last sort of, you know, petals of the flower were getting plucked off. And I just still felt like something was missing. And I still felt like there was some obvious thing that I hadn't seen. And I went back through earlier in the book and I was like, wow, I keep talking about how this Mike guy had this angry side that, like, Kelly had to be sort of his emotional shepherd and Kelly had to be the one that sort of regulated emotion for him. And she's gone now. And I remember I was just sort of, like, sitting at my computer and all of a sudden, like, and it was like in the movie where they flash back to all these earlier scenes when you should have known. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I didn't realize that. So the characters sort of set it up on their own without me realizing. And I was very surprised and I had to do a little bit more, you know, dropping of breadcrumbs once I knew that to make sure it all fit. And I had to change a few logistics for who was where, when, but really it was already there. And I was like, how creepy that I, like, wrote a killer into the book and didn't even realize it. And here we are. And she almost married him.
She did. And you had me convinced that Nathan was covering for Sabrina. I thought she was going to be the dark horse and, like, mess stuff up.
Yeah, I think kind of my favorite thing about the book is that you spend the entire time thinking Sabrina and Nathan are so sketchy, and they're, like, kind of the only non-sketchy characters in the book.
Yeah.
They're actually, like, pretty good people. I mean, obviously they're being a little sketchy. They're withholding information about their past and everything, but, like, out of everyone, they're probably the best people.
Yeah. And so, kind of follow up on the twist there. So we know that Mike lets Kelly go, but all that rage, like, doesn't go away. And is Kelly safe, you know, after this? And for some reason,
I have to make a confession. The entire time I was figuring out that it was him and he kills Elizabeth, all I could think was Legally Blonde. I didn't mean to shoot him. I thought it was you walking through the door. And I was like, I don't know why, but this is the narrative in my head of like, he's like, I didn't mean to kill her. I meant to kill you. Like, I lost my dang mind.
Oh my gosh. I haven't watched Legally Blonde in so long. And this is making me, I actually started it on a plane not too long ago, but I didn't get to the end. So I didn't get to the critical scene, but yes. Maybe it's somewhere deep in my psyche that I was pulling from.
You had a little chutney in you.
It's what?
You had a little chutney in you.
I did somewhere deep inside, but is Kelly safe? I mean, whenever people ask me about the future of my characters, I'm like, oh, the world ends for me when I close the book. So like readers are free to spin whatever future they want out of it. But like, for me, that is a finite ending. I think she is safe because he's like clearly horrified about what he did and very sorry about it. And now he's sort of under her thumb, like in a sense, she has the upper hand for the first time. And yeah, it's no longer her responsibility to take care of him, but she has given him sort of the gift of a free pass in order to save herself, in order to prevent herself from being in trouble for all of the crimes of, you know, omission and cover up and abetting and all the other things she did. And he will forever kind of owe her. So yeah, I think she's just completely separate from him, and he's going to be in Philly and she's going to be in Chicago, and never the two shall meet.
Yeah, it's a thank you next moment.
Mm-hmm.
And Kelly really didn't like Elizabeth anyway. So I don't know, maybe there's something a little sinister about her too. That's just like, thanks.
Right, she's gonna mourn the loss of Nate forever. Like, that part is gonna be devastating, but like, yeah, not having Elizabeth around, I don't think she would ever admit this. I don't think she would even think this to herself, but yeah, if someone has to die, it'd be really convenient if it was gonna be Elizabeth, and like maybe some part of her
really convenient that.
Dark thoughts, sorry.
Dark thoughts. This is what my books do.
Oh gosh. Okay. So we love the dedication in your book to everyone who rethought everything. Can you dive into that? Meaning why this particular dedication? What was your inspiration?
Yeah. I normally have the hardest time figuring out my dedications. And this one, I don't even think I had finished the book by the time I had this. Oh, the dog wants in. Come along. Stop scratching. Hi. Sorry, they needed to both be present for this.
All good. We love a fur baby cameo.
Yes. They're just snuffling in the corner. For this book, I think I, for the first time ever, had the dedication figured out before I had even finished the book. And I knew that, again, for me, this was sort of a tale parallel to my own rethinking of everything. And I knew how scary that was and how much bravery it took to, inform people. I didn't really have like a big official coming out. I just started dating a woman and then let people know, like, this is my girlfriend. So I soft launched it in that sense, but, it took a lot of bravery and was very worth it. But it took bravery not only to tell people, but before that to make the decision to like shake things up and live authentically and, you know, be real with myself and present my true self to the people around me and to readers everywhere. So I felt like it was really clear that I needed to express that to readers and to sort of give a nod, I see you, to everyone else who at any point, whether it was pandemic related or not, took that leap of faith and did the thing that was hard, but completely worth it. And I think, I guess if I had to say that I was inspired by any dedication. I always really loved Jessica Knowles' dedication in Luckiest Girl Alive, which is something like, to all the women, oh, I'm going to get it wrong, but it was basically something implying like to all of the victims of, I just remember it ended with, I know. And what she was expressing was like, I get it. And I see you and I understand all of the other victims of sexual assault who've come before me. And I just thought that was such an impactful way to, I don't know, nod at all the people who have gone through something difficult, come out the other side. And yeah, people have really responded to it. People, I've never had so many people, you know, ask more about it or say that it really spoke to them. So I love that even though a lot of people didn't come out during the pandemic, like myself, I think a lot of us know that experience of like, I'm going to just rethink everything and throw away everything I thought I knew about myself and just embrace that.
Yeah.
A little teary.
It's like, it was really, really good.
Yeah, I was like, oh, emotions. I felt like I was rambling a little, so I'm
no, not. No, you're good. So, speaking of dedications, your sister's book dedication, The Writing Retreat by Julia Bartz, speaks of watching horror movies. Is this like a Bartz sister tradition? Do you have a favorite film?
Oh my gosh, we are such horror aficionados and we always have been. I mean, when we were like little, we were reading Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark and we were reading, you know, Goosebumps and Christopher Pike and Lois Duncan, and we were just complete addicts of scary stuff even when we were small. We co-wrote a like spec script of The X-Files because The X-Files was our favorite show when we were young, which is weird in retrospect. But anyway,
I liked The X-Files too.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. We were just kind of weird kids. And yeah, as adults, we both love horror movies. We lived together for a long time. And so when we lived together, that was sort of our like a nighttime treat. If we were like, oh, let's watch a movie tonight. We had a huge shared doc with some other friends of ours who like horror movies of recommendations. And now we don't live together, but whenever we get together, we're going upstate together actually later this week. And we already have a running list of like the horror movies that we have saved up that we're going to watch together. Nice. So yeah, I think we just both like that kind of storytelling. We love how real people are when they're really scared and like seeing how people are sort of pushed to an extreme when their life is threatened. And I think we just both have sort of an addiction to being scared while watching something and like that intense, fun sensation of very safely exploring dark things, which is why probably we both write dark, very dark books.
Well, that plays directly into my next question. With her debut novel, have you both always been writers together? And did you play a part in her publishing journey and or help like edit or anything like that with her book?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we both, as I said, we both grew up just writing stories all the time and collaborating on cute little picture books. We had a series called The Ghost Gang, and it was like a ghost, a zombie, a werewolf. We like drew the little illustrations. It was very cute. So yeah, we were both creative storytellers growing up. And then in college, I discovered magazine journalism and was sort of like, oh, forget creative writing. Like, I want to be a magazine editor. This is what I want to pursue 100%. And so I sort of left fiction writing behind and focused on that, while my sister, she studied magazine journalism and creative writing. And she kind of from the start really wanted to be an author, wanted to be writing fiction. So our paths kind of split after graduation, where I was really focused on magazines and the magazine industry, as I'm sure you know, was sort of like collapsing beneath me, right under my feet. And she was, you know, working a full-time job, but really focusing on writing in the meantime. And she actually, this is her first book published, but the third book that she has written.
Okay.
And her first two books were literary fiction. And, you know, she got as far as agent querying. She had an agent for one of them, but neither one got published, which I know was, you know, a hard situation and a disappointing thing. And in the meantime, I was in magazines and I just kept walking into work and like finding out that the magazine that I worked at folded. It kept happening to me. And I was like, this industry, like, I love it, but it's just imploding while I'm in the middle of it. And I went into work one day with a magazine I loved working on and found out that we were folding. And I was like, I really need to work on something that is mine and that I care about and that I enjoy doing and that I feel strongly about, but that I can't just like wake up one Tuesday and find out it's all been taken away from me. It was a Tuesday. I remember that very specifically. And in the meantime, my sister was like, okay, I have this idea for another book, but if I'm going to write and if I'm going to invest so much in another book, it needs to be out of a love of writing. And it needs to be, I need to enjoy the experience and not just do it with sort of this eye to publishing it. And I don't know if you guys have read The Writing Retreat, but it very much is about the frustration and the experience of like trying to write and trying to make it in an industry that's very cutthroat. And so she sort of decided to pour her frustrations into that right around the same time that I was like, oh, I've been kicking around this murder mystery idea. I'm going to start writing that. I'm going to really double down and work on it. And I had just been laid off, so I had more time than normal. And so we pretty much at the same time, she started The Writing Retreat and I started The Lost Night. And, we just are very different personalities where I, you know, dedicated myself to it really full time. And I was like, I'm going to finish by this date and I'm going to revise it. And then I'm going to query agents and I'm going to try to like make this a thing, you know, this is like a really big freelance writing project. Whereas my sister started writing on it, was kind of working on it on and off. And then in the meantime decided like, I'm going to do a career shift. I want to become a therapist. She went to school for social work and found this like really fulfilling new career for herself and worked on the writing on and off. So, this is getting really long-winded, but it's all to say we continued to support each other, read each other's manuscripts. And, you know, she was so happy for me when my first book did come out, The Lost Night, even though she, like any humans, she experienced, you know, envy and jealousy in addition to being really happy for me. But she's also said that like seeing me do it and seeing me go through this process was part of what inspired her to keep going and to actually like finish this book and try to make it happen. And I just, as soon as she finally let me read a draft of The Writing Retreat, I just knew it was going to connect with people and it was going to be huge, which it was. It debuted on the New York Times bestseller list. So I couldn't be happier for her. And we have sort of different methods and different approaches and different speeds that we want to write with. But in the end, I think, you know, we both write really dark and sort of psychologically complex thrillers. And if you like her stuff, you'll probably like mine. And if you like my stuff, I think you will like The Writing Retreat.
And you mutually love horror movies. So that holds up.
It all makes sense, right?
makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think her book is a little bit more horror than mine.
I would say so.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking back to your like book talk videos that you do talking about the queries and all of these things. And so I have not read her book yet, but it seems like kind of this is a behind the scenes of the emotional side of everything that you're putting to practical use of like, this is how you do this.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this is what it feels like.
Yeah. No, I think that's really true. Like what we were saying before about social media is, you know, I'm like expressing in these like quick little bites, like this is how you query an agent. And like, doesn't that seem straightforward? But like in truth, it's so much more complex than that. And like the rejection, the intense and immense amount of rejection that you get as a writer is like really hard to deal with. And, you know, you need a supportive community to do it. And, you know, I'm super grateful that my sister is now in the same field so we can like talk about this stuff and she gets in and we can support each other because yeah, no matter how fun it looks from the outside, a lot of it is really hard. I'm so grateful, and I want to be clear, I'm very, very grateful that I get to write my crazy, you know, creepy stories for a living, but also a lot of it is really difficult, and I feel really lucky to have a community to kind of get through that.
You power through. It's not easy, but then you get to become New York Times best-selling author.
Yeah, that's the first time one of my books has had that, you know, on the cover from past publications. So this is a different energy going into this publication.
For sure. So, you know, we always ask your favorite books, but we already know. And I read Virgin Suicides, so thank you for that. That was so good. And I need to read The Bell Jar, but I got one. I'm 50% there. And so thank you for that recommendation. But what book have you read in the past year that you think everyone should read?
A book that I read in the last year that I think everyone should read. I'm going to let Zelda scratching at the door be a moment of thinking. Oh, I read so many good books. And I'm trying to think if I've read classics. Well, I finally read, here's one that I just think everyone would enjoy. I finally read The Fifth Season, N.K. Jemisin, just part of the Broken Earth trilogy. It's the first one. And I don't normally read sci-fi. This was my first book of hers. She's huge. And I'm sure a lot of people hearing this are like, how could you not have already read N.K. Jemisin? But the book is absolutely brilliant and so entertaining. And it is subtly feminist, and it is subtly, you know, has subtle themes of racial justice, and it's sort of Afrofuturist, and it's so friggin' good. It's just so good that I don't think any thinking person with good taste would not enjoy it. So that's a recommendation if you want to just get sucked in to an entirely different world that has nothing to do with ours. It is so great.
Add to cart.
Yeah, sure. And so is there anything else you want to share with your listeners about The Spare Room? Anything that we didn't ask that you would love to tell?
That is a great question. Let me think. You guys had excellent questions, so I feel like you really hit on a lot. I mean, I have been warning / telling people that this is spicier than my earlier books. And I feel like I want to be upfront about it, because if someone's like really not expecting it, then that might be a turnoff. I personally think it's, you know, an asset. I think it's a feature, not a bug. And it's not terribly explicit. It's not terribly graphic. It's not every page, but it is about a woman who is, you know, having this like sexual reawakening in her 30s and realizing this new part of her sexual identity, as she falls in love with this couple. So of course, you know, a little bit of spice is going to be a part of it. So it's interesting. I think some people are reacting as if, you know, there's been reviews saying this basically reminded me of 50 Shades of Grey. And somebody said, trigger warning, lots of smut. And I'm kind of like, I don't know that it's actually smutty, or if you're a little bit thrown off by the fact that this is queer sex, that this is a poly situation. This is definitely non-traditional. Those things are true, because there's not actually on a page-to-page level all that much sex, and it's definitely not explicit. But it is spicy, because this is like a romantic, you know, there's a romantic element to this book that is not present in my other books. So hopefully that is, yes, hopefully that is a selling point for a lot of readers, but
it's like two and a half readers, peppers out of five.
But you know what? Everyone who's made it this far has already read it, and they already know. So because if you haven't read it, then we've just ruined the entire book for you. So yeah, so I guess actually I'll go one degree further, and I'll say kudos to you for reading it, I assume, and getting this far, because a lot of people were way too turned off by the queer themes. And so I salute you for being open to that, and for, you know, hopefully enjoying a little bit of spiciness that is not just a man and a woman, you know, in a sort of coho way. No hate to coho, but
no. And I told Laura
flat the immediate out, like, oh no, to be fair,
they're gonna come get you
too far.
No, direct quote for me. I was like, this is spicy. It's not smutty.
And I like that.
The pandemic, like the not being able to touch each other, I feel like that just like amplified how like spicy it was. And you're in this mansion with so much space, but there's physical touch in this place. And so I feel like all of it came together in just this like touchy-feely kind of way. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I hadn't really even thought about that, but you're so right. Like, remember we were talking about being touch starved, and even early on, she's remarking on some article she saw about, you know, neurons in your brain that, you know, are when you're like stroking a cat, then there, it activates the like, you know, pleasure and touch parts of your own brain. Yeah, there was this weird time when you just like couldn't hug people or like couldn't get a massage if that's a thing you like to do. And we were all just so sort of, yeah, starved for affection and touch. And like here she found it and just doubly, triply, quadruply dove in headfirst.
Yeah, because it's even like right in the very beginning, she talks about like when they like finally take their masks off in the car and they're like breathing the same air. I was like, that's even kind of sexy where you're like, look at us breathing the same air.
Yeah,
how vulnerable really... and exposed are we?
Truly, you were like, I'm risking my life to be near you. And I remember feeling that way when I went to live with this friend and their whole family. I got picked up at the train station and we were like, can we hug? And then in the car, we're like, I guess we can take our masks off. And it just felt very, again, it was not sexy in that particular instance, but it was just very intimate to be like, oh, yeah, we're like, we're going to be in each other's pod. Like we're becoming a family for the time that we're sharing this air. And that's very weird.
Something very intimate about that, that I don't think any of us would have ever thought about.
Truly. Truly. Time. Yeah, if you would have told us a few years ago what was coming.
And then it's just, for some reason, my mind jumps to the juxtaposition of sharing the same air as people in an airplane. And I'm like, that's so unsexy. Mm-hmm. Everything about that is so disgusting. Mm-hmm. Opposite.
Yeah, or like a subway car. I'm in New York. It's like, I don't want to be breathing air with all you people.
You're like, let me just have my spicy little car.
Yeah.
So how can people find you online, support your work, and anything coming up down the pipeline that we should be on the lookout for?
Great question. There's a couple of things, but I can't share them yet. So watch this space. But yeah, I'm on TikTok and Instagram and Twitter and a little bit on Facebook. And Yeah, more exciting things to come. Well, I'm working on the fifth book, but in the meantime, there's some other exciting things that I hope to be able to share soon. So you should not have to wait quite that long to hear more from me for the next book.
We have feelings, and I just see that right there. And that's what I think.
Oh, no one's going to know because you're pointing, but no, I'll tell you.
No. Okay. Interesting. There is
cool news, and it's not related to that in particular.
Huh. Okay.
Well, I will say I'm also not personally very involved in it, but there is a Netflix adaptation of We Were Never Here that's coming to the screen, and apparently it's barreling ahead. There's a script that exists, and they're looking for directors, I hear. So I don't personally have a lot. I hear stuff down the, you know, sort of down the grapevine, but that'll be an exciting way to sort of see the Andrea Bartz universe expanded beyond books.
Yeah, that's very awesome. Cool.
Congrats.
Thanks. Yeah.
And happy pub day.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me on. It's always really fun to talk to you.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming. Thank you for sending us the book ahead of time. It felt really cool.
My pleasure.
Like no one can get this right now. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. Hopefully
we'll see you next year for book five with more robes.
2025 will be the next, will be the next book. So in 2 years, we'll be doing this again with even more excitement and even more pet stories.
Perfect.
Sounds great.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks again. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
What a great interview. Thank you again and happy pub day to Andy. That's all we have for you today, guys. We will announce our July book club pick during our recap episode, which will air during the last week of June. Thank you guys so much for listening, and thank you so much for your support. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Decanterbury Pod, Facebook, Decanterbury Tales the Podcast, Goodreads, Decanterbury Tales the Podcast. We're now on LinkedIn, y'all. So, like, hit us up professionally, Decanterbury Tales. And, you know, y'all, until then, bottoms up and stay weird. Goodbye. This has been another episode of Decanterbury Tales, the podcast. If you've enjoyed our show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It is the best way to support our show and make sure it shows up for new listeners. Follow us on Instagram at Decanterbury Pod, Facebook, Decanterbury Tales, the podcast, Goodreads, Decanterbury Tales, and LinkedIn, Decanterbury Tales. You can visit our website, www.decanterburytales.com, and write us an email at decanterburypod@gmail.com. Tell us your stories or recommend a book or pairing. We love to hear from you. Decanterbury Tales is a totally independent, female-owned and operated production. Thank you so much, and cheers!